basis for 25 years. So it's a pleasure to be able to attend my first SEC after missing the last two and be able to help out. And I hope everybody has had a good time here. Because we can't concentrate somewhat on solar today, it's not the best known part of the observatory's history, really. I wanted to present some things on the solar history here at Mount Wilson. It actually started as Mount Wilson Solar Observatory just over 100 years ago. So, this represents the understanding of the sun certainly far before this observatory was founded in 1904. And get a few lights on here. So this observatory is founded. The official founding date is in December 1904. So we celebrated our centennial a few years ago. And the founder was George Ellery Hale, who had previously founded the Yerkes Observatory with the world's largest telescope, a 40-inch refractor, which is still there. And he wanted a place to do more of what he referred to as astrophysics. It was a new term. It was something new that people were doing then. The new astronomy, actually trying to figure out the physics of physical objects in the sky. Many people thought we'd never know what the stars and the sun are made out of, but he felt differently. This is Hale here on his first trip up to the mountain. It includes W.W. Campbell from Lick Observatory and others with this telescope producing site survey for a possible solar observatory at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. And the result of that was to find that the sun's images seen from the summit of Mount Wilson is apparently better defined than at any other point hitherto tested with a telescope. That was the report of the committee, including Hale, to Carnegie Institution, which had been founded by a philanthropist, Andrew Carnegie. So Hale came up here again himself. This is his own telescope here, and what you can see is called Wilson's Peak on the monument there. It's staying in a building of unknown origin, referred to as the casino for reasons that nobody seems to know. He brought with him a Cetostat, a solar telescope. This is known as the Wadesboro Cetostat. It was used in 1900 for the eclipse in Wadesboro, North Carolina. So it was a temporary solar telescope. And this is the way solar telescopes were used then. They would take them to eclipses to see what they could do on the sun during that unique time. But they were not ordinarily used for studying the sun in between. And here Hale on the right is... looks like he's got an eyepiece there. Some others are setting it up. So this was the first solar telescope that was brought here to the mountain. Now Hale, in here, is behind what is known as the monastery, the dormitory where that he built for the astronomers to stay in. And it was named for, actually, because he was reading something called the Monasteries of the Levant, not because he didn't allow women to stay on the mountain. That policy's changed, of course. But he had C.G. Abbott. He also had Walter Adams, who followed him as director. Ferdinand Elliman, he brought with him from Yerkes. E.E. Barnard was part of this expedition from Yerkes Observatory. And here's a great shot of Ferdinand Elliman. It shows something about the take care of it yourself attitude that they had at this time. There really wasn't any choice. So this is Ferdinand Elliman a few years later, solar observer, who did many, many things. We'll see him more in this. Transportation was not quite the same as the modern transportation now. These burros were used to bring up all of the materials to the mountain. The snow telescope, the first telescope on the mountain, required 60 trips of these burros, who all had their own personalities. And the people who took care of them apparently had very colorful personalities as well. And this is some of the material coming up. It was a 9.5 mile arduous trail from the valley down below. It was the only way to get up here. It was a 2-foot-wide trail. This is a part of the spectrograph of the snow telescope being brought up the trail. Near the top, they developed this special carriage because it was very, very narrow on the trail. So this was only 20 inches wide from a 0.5 meter between the left and right wheels. And it can be steered here and also in the back in order to make it around the curves. And it successfully got up here almost all the time. But even with something like that, they couldn't quite make it up here all the time. This is the Snow Telescope. Some of you had the chance to see that earlier today. It has been here for over 100 years now. It was in use at Yerkes Observatory before that, and it was more of a temporary building there. It was brought here on a temporary basis, and is still here over 100 years later. It was eventually paid for, so it's now part of owned by Carnegie Institution of Washington. And it is a horizontal cetostat, and I'll show you what that means here in a moment. The main thing here is the idea was, and this is sort of in transition, a 30-foot high pier to place the first mirrors, which are placed out in the sun to keep them away from the heating on the ground, which distorts the images. And the construction of the telescope here. So for the most part, the telescope is horizontal on flat ground, but out here where the mirrors are in the sun, it is high above the ground. This is canvas covering the building to keep the sun off of it, to reduce problems with heat inside the building. That's been replaced by metal, of course. Two mirrors out here, the first one to reflect the sun up to the second mirror and direct it down into the telescope where it reaches the primary mirror where the image is formed. The first one here tracks the mirror. This telescope, as you saw today, if you were in there, is exactly the same as it was then. Same DC motors, same plate glass mirrors, except that they're aluminized now instead of silver. Otherwise, it's virtually identical to what it was. These are the two mirrors, so this is the one, same as it is now, reflects the light, tracks the sun, reflects the light here and into the telescope where it's shaded from the sun. And this is the primary mirror. And I understand that you know, many eclipse enthusiasts are not necessarily astronomers, so I won't go into technical details, but I'll be glad to talk about it with anybody anytime during the weekend. So, but it is a 24-inch, 0.6-meter plate glass mirror. The focal length is 60 feet, so it's F30. Those of you who don't know what all that means, just ignore it. And it was visible from the monastery. This is the first monastery which burned down in a kitchen fire after a few years. But I like this view of it from up here for a couple of reasons. One, it's a nice, pretty view. And two, it shows another solar aspect, the solar heating that they had in the first decade of the 20th century. This is an example of what they can do. Now, this is actually in calcium K. This is, if you were to take Coronado or Daystar filter or something and look at in H-alpha, many of us are familiar with that. They were doing this 100 years ago with the spectroheliograph. In this case, it's the calcium K line. This was taken in 1905. And they can get full disk images. This was an invention of George Ellery Hale to be able to do this using the spectrograph of the telescope. And this is the device. You still have the framework of this in the Snow Telescope. The optics and so on are gone. And they used prisms. They didn't have large diffraction gratings. Okay, let's back to something that's not technical. This is the trail as it existed when the Snow Telescope was built. But they had plans for larger solar telescopes as well as a 60-inch telescope for nighttime use. It would be the largest telescope in the world. That was going to be built here. Hale felt that even though he referred to himself as a sun worshiper, which apparently was for two reasons. One, he liked to study the sun, and two, he preferred Southern California to Southern Wisconsin. So he wanted to have a large telescope that could study the physics of the stars as well, because the sun is the only star we can see up close, so you need to look at others as well. So this is what they had to make a road out of, and here they are trying to do that. Now, I've never understood how this is possible, but I'm not an engineer. And here they are building it up. And in time, it was big enough for this kind of vehicle. Now, this is a hybrid vehicle. Again, they're way ahead of their time. But it was a very odd one, and I just have to show this because it's so interesting. You see there are four solid wheels here. Each one has an electric motor. The electricity is generated by an internal combustion engine. So it runs like a regular car, except that just runs the generators and supply power to the wheels. So it's four-wheel drive, electric, with its own onboard generator, and the front wheels are steered up here, the rear wheels are steered by this guy, and the sensible people walk behind it. The material here is actually from a mail order wind vane tower that was going to be used for a new solar telescope experiment on the mountain, and this is it. This is what's supposed to be holding a wind vane or something else on a tower, but instead they put CetaSat mirrors and made a vertical telescope to get the optics as far above the ground as possible. And here it's actually going up with a dome, but this adapter was experimented with and found to work very well, and pretty much as it looks right now. But this was an experiment to see if putting the lens of the telescope 60 feet above the ground would improve the image, and indeed it did. And it allowed them to get these kinds of images. And this is a little bit ahead of the time that was done, but here's a good sunspot that's recorded in the slit and the spectrum, and they're able to see a little bit more about this in a moment, where the sunspot affects the absorption lines in the spectrum. This allowed Hale to do one of the things he's been trying to do for several years, and it's commonly considered to be one of the most important things ever done here at Mount Wilson Observatory. This was 99 years ago, 1908, when he was able to demonstrate that these vortices that he saw and looked so much like magnetic field lines actually were magnetic field lines and sunspots on the sun. This was very important because, remember, we know all about things that happen in space that are very similar to here, but at that time they didn't know these things. There was no known magnetic field outside of the Earth. This was the first time anybody did that. So it's a very big leap, the first time to see something like this in space. In fact, we always remember this was June 25th, 1908, that he made this discovery, was able to prove it. And for those who are astronomers and are interested in this kind of thing, this is the original logbook from the 60-foot tower. And in fact, here is June 25th, 1908, and these are the plates that were taken. And one of these, or more, we're not quite sure, are the ones in which he discovered that magnetic field. And in fact, this is one of the images from that day. These are thanks to a scanning project that's taking place at UCLA right now. So one of these sunspots here, the ones they were looking at, those are the ones where magnetic field was found for the first time on the Earth 99 years ago. Hale was something of an astronomical entrepreneur. Here he's standing next to Andrew Carnegie, from whom he got additional money to build a 60-inch telescope, which is being dedicated in the dome behind him on a nice foggy day up here in December of 1908. He was very much a diplomat, but also sometimes even undiplomatic in getting his way and getting money in founding Yerkes Observatory, Mount Wilson, and Palomar. And by the way, I'll mention, I'll put in a plug, that there is on PBS in the United States, sometime in the spring probably, will be a documentary called Journey to Palomar. And this is about this story, and everybody who has a chance, whether you're here or not, should see this, because I've seen it several times and it's great. So, and here Hale is doing his diplomatic part. First of all, Carnegie was a little bit self-conscious about being short, so Hale always positioned himself a little bit downhill. And he also had the good sense not to tell the richest man in the world that he had buttoned his coat wrong.
Oh, yeah.
This is the 60-inch telescope, and this was the largest telescope in the world. By a lot, it was the first large successful reflector at the time, and it was able to do things that other telescopes were not in any way. It had a coup d'etat focus, for example, was able to use larger instruments. Very, very important, not only the world's biggest, but the world's best telescope. It was still part of Mount Wilson Solar Observatory, and it was many years before that name was changed. Well, once Hale had found that his experiment for the 60-foot tower was successful, he decided to build a bigger one. In about 1910 or so, he started working on the 150-foot tower, large tower across the street here that many of you got a chance to visit. Here you can see the tower starting to go up, and a person standing here with a pick who has dug the first 3 feet of the pit for the spectrograph and has only 77 more feet digging through rock to go. It was all dug by hand. The framework is going up here. They've cast some concrete piers. They found a lunatic on the top of the tower. These guys were very proud of their work. There's another one. And the completed 150-foot tower, I won't go into too much about the technical aspects. This is the largest, most powerful telescope in the world. From the time that it was completed in around 1912 until the 1950s, when the larger one, the McMahon-Pierce telescope in Arizona, Kitt Peak, was built. And here are the three telescopes all together. They eventually came back here and made this permanent with the dome. So those are the three telescopes all built between years 1905 and about 1912. All of them the first of their kind, or best of their kind. Very quickly, the light comes, in this case, to the first mirror, up to the second mirror, and then comes to a lens here. So you have a telescope which is 12-inch diameter lens, which is now a triplet lens, originally a doublet, forms the image down here 150 feet farther away, and has a 70-foot spectrograph down below, which produces an extraordinarily good spectrum of the sun. Here's an example of sunlight coming in and going through the lens, and down into the spectrograph. I won't go into the details of this sort of thing. This is how you get up to the top so you can set the mirrors to get it started in the morning. This person is not 9 feet tall and this one 2 feet tall. She's afraid of heights, so she's down, kneeling down here. He's standing up on the edge. But if this is scary, too scary to go up, and it is kind of exciting, the other way is to use a ladder, which is the only way they had at the beginning. One of the important things that happened in 1910 was a meeting of the International Solar Union. That's now known as the International Astronomical Union. This picture is a who's who of solar astronomy, solar physics, and astronomy at the beginning of the 20th century. And everybody made the trip up here. It was a fairly rugged trip, just getting here to Southern California, which is very much the Wild West, and getting up to the mountain. The 150-foot tower allowed improvements in imaging and spectroscopy like this. This, in this case, is a very strong spot, which is causing the magnetic field to split. The absorption line, this is something that had been discovered several years before by Zeeman in Germany, I believe, and in the laboratory, and it's one of the things that Hale used to show that the magnetic field existed on the sun. One of the other things that was discovered here, the magnetic polarity of sunspots. We've all heard the sun eclipse chasers know that the corona is affected by the whether or not the sun is near minimum or maximum. And so we know there's not only an 11-year sunspot cycle, but it's really a 22-year cycle because the magnetic field's reversed. And this is a drawing from the famous paper of 1919, which Hale and Nicholson showed the current cycle and the new cycle. This was the first change from one cycle to another that had been observed with this instrument, and showed that, in fact, the magnetic reversal took place. So it's really a 22-year cycle, not the 11-year cycle that had been obvious before. Well, one of the other incidental things that happened that I won't talk about, because it's never used on the sun, is the building of the 100-inch telescope. It was only a couple of years after the 100-inch telescope, then by far the largest telescope in the world, was built, that the word solar was dropped from the name and became Mount Wilson Observatory. This telescope was the largest in the world until 1948, when the 200-inch, which was also started by Hale at Palomar, was built. Hale never lived to see that one completed, but it was named the Hale Telescope in his honor. And of course, everyone knows that Edwin Hubble used that to make discoveries about galaxies and so on. And the observatory here is usually most known for this kind of work, especially Hubble, ever since the Space Telescope was named in honor of him. But there are many, of course, other things that happened throughout the observatory's history. And again, we're focusing on the solar with this because this is a solar conference, I guess. Another very important one that is not really talked about as much, there's some astronomers here who will know about this, near the 1920s, they developed a photographic map of the sunspot spectrum, that is, all those splits in the lines that say something about the magnetic fields and give us that information. They made a map of that, and this is it, red to blue, all of these exposures here, with the 150-foot tower in exquisite detail. And each of these things is a split. They're using basically it's like a polarizer to show one side of the split and then the other, so you can sort of see a little bit better, gives you better contrast. This is made available to observatories anywhere in the world. We really didn't have the kind of facilities that were available here. This also, eclipses also happened then too, as we know. I talked about the Waynesboro, North Carolina eclipse in 1900. This is 1923. Last time we had an eclipse in Southern California. The place they chose was down near San Diego. It was cloudy on that day, so they weren't able to observe at all. But this is the instrumentation that they used. Somebody may say, what the heck is that? Well, I would say the same thing if I could find anybody that had the answer. But nobody really does. All we know is that this framework was taken from the 50-foot interferometer here, a large experimental, partly successful instrument, and used to hold I don't know what kind of objects. All for naught. Now, some of you here can read this better than I can. One of the people who contacted the observatory here, because it was by far the best place for doing this kind of research, was Albert Einstein, who wrote in early on about the possibility of observing stars during an eclipse and the bending of starlight due to the gravitational field of the sun. The work was not done by Mount Wilson. That was done by somebody else, I think, in the 1919 eclipse. Eddington, I believe somebody may correct me on that. But he did write here about it first, and in fact, later on in 1931, he came here to visit, and this is at the top of the 150-foot solar tower, where it's often very windy, so he's having even a worse hair day than you. It attracted a lot of attention here, especially because of the entertainment industry. Newsreels were done here. This is Seth Nicholson, who did a lot of early work with George Hale. One of the people who was on the mountain, a few of you might have met, was Don Nicholson, who is still involved here, and is Seth Nicholson's son. Another eclipse expedition, this is interesting, these pictures were provided by the granddaughter of this person, Edison Hoag, who was a photographer and an observing assistant, an early film camera, a really nice looking telescope back there kept out of the sun. I don't know any of the details about any of these things, except that this was in Lancaster, New Hampshire in 1932. For that eclipse, and I believe they were successful there, but I don't know anything more about it. Ferdinand Ellerman, who you saw under the car earlier, Walter Adams, who by then was the director of the observatory, setting up more equipment. Now, as we got on in time, of course, the white light photography continued. This is the largest sunspot ever observed here. I think it's been observed and photographed ever, 1947, an enormous sunspot group that lasted for more than two rotations. And so there have been a lot of interesting pictures like this all along. Here's another odd-shaped sunspot that occurred. It seems to have some sort of magnetic field lines trailing behind it. Both were taken with a 60-foot tower. Hale retired because of illness, and he stayed in Pasadena down below, but he had this built, the Hale Solar Laboratory, in which he built a really fine seamstep and telescope for solar work that he continued on his own. And here he is there at the Hale Solar Lab, in Pasadena, where he did a lot of work. And in fact, that facility continued to be used after his death in the 1930s. This is the first solar magnetograph, something for actually measuring, making measurements of the strength of the magnetic fields. This was done by Horace Babcock, who worked with his father, Harold, who was on the staff from the very beginning, and later became the director of the observatory as well. And we have it back. He'll go back up. An improved version of this was later taken up to the 150-foot solar tower. But this magnetograph at the Hale Solar Lab is actually the first one to very, very measure the general magnetic field of the sun, which is the magnetic fields of the sunspots are really intense, very strong. But just the fact that there are magnetic fields on the sun in the same way there is a magnetic field on the Earth was much more difficult to show. This is the one that did that. This is one of the observers in the 1950s, I think, the 150-foot solar tower, who I probably embarrassed him by showing this because he's here in the audience, named Livingston, who did a lot of work here and was able to tell me a few things about the Snow Telescope earlier. I hope we'll add more to our history here. Another very important thing that was done that is continued here, Robert Layton of Caltech with some others, velocity fields in the solar atmosphere. This is a very boring way of saying he found oscillations in the sun. He was able to measure with the 60-foot solar tower that the sun pulsates, but not a whole thing like a semi-drone. There are small areas that pulsate up and down like this. This is the oscillation modes. The sun actually is like a gigantic drum, and there are these waves traveling within it that causes it to rise up and down. We're talking about just a few meters per second here that he was able to detect, but it developed in what is called helioseismology, seismology of the sun. Very important field right now. This is a map that's taken now daily at the 60-foot solar tower and some others, and this is actually a map of the gases rising and falling on the solar surface. Now, why is this important? Here's a later observer who became assistant director, eventually director of the National Solar Observatory, Robert Howard, showing the fashion of the day in the early 1960s, how one keeps warm, with an early version of the magnetograph, 150-foot solar tower. Here he has updated his look from the 1970s, so he took more in place with the new computers that were brought here. I have to say some of this equipment is still there, but not all of it, fortunately. And so things did get continuously updated. Now, Bob Howard did some very important work. Again, scientific paper. Sun observed to be a torsional oscillator with a period of 11 years. That's a scientific speak, but he was able to show that over the period of 11 years of the sunspot cycle, non-magnetic part of it, that there were other types of oscillations that were taking place within the sun, and it was far more complicated than was expected. The 5-minute oscillations, this is what Bob Layton first discovered, that these oscillations take place over a period of 5 minutes on the sun all the time, but Roger Ulrich, who's now in charge from UCLA, is in charge of the program of 150-foot solar tower, was able to show that not only was there a 5-minute oscillation, but you can take theory and show that there should be other standing waves. So there are many, many, many different types of waves going on in the sun. You wouldn't think with something that's got that kind of energy that it would be able to maintain these different kinds of vibrations, but it does. It just sits there and vibrates in many ways continuously. And here is, this is really a record. You can see the repeatability, and I won't go into anything more than that, but the rotations of the sun over a period of, this is a full 22 years. These are simply magnetic fields and motion on the sun plotted in different ways. So there's a great deal of more information that was found. Now, one of the other things Roger Ulrich is doing is he realized that there are records of what happened on the sun in some ways going back almost 100 years. They've been taking pictures of various kinds continuously since Hale Gale's time, and many of the people who work here are just continuing that work. In this case, it's just like the one I showed you from 1905. This is the number of these, each year, the number of these types of photographs in that particular line of calcium shows solar activity that were taken over the years. So he actually started to go to the archives and scan all of these so that they could be used for long-term studies. And Mount Wilson in general, despite the big discoveries that took place, is really most important both in solar and stellar work for the long-term studies it's done. Looking at stars over a long period of time, looking at the sun over a long period of time, is not done in most places. This is a small part of the archive that has been scanned, and this work is ongoing. Well, as the work continues, there is also more and more public outreach. This is Larry Webster, the Chief Solar Observer, here showing a tour, touring group, the sun and what happens when the light goes through a prism and so on. The Snow Solar Telescope, after more than 100 years, has been updated in only one way. We have a CCD camera on the spectrograph now. So the sensor, the detector, is updated. It goes into a computer, and we can do better work. But it is used primarily by students like this. We have a program every year. Many people here might know somebody who would be good for this. It's called Curia. It's primarily for undergraduate physics and astronomy majors. And they use the Snow Telescope for 2 weeks, as well as other telescopes at night, making sunspot drawings, but also using the spectrograph to do some things that Hale wasn't able to do in his time without those things. And if you didn't get into the Snow Telescope, this is a little bit of what you miss, like going to the primary mirror, people viewing the spectrum here. And I have to say that after 100 years, you've learned a great deal about what happens on the sun and inside the sun from all the different models of the sun. So that is it for this talk. So thank you very much. I'll say that I won't turn on the lights. We have a few different talks to do, and it's too much trouble with these lights. I can take a few questions if we want to before we go on to the next. Anybody? Now, I'd like to introduce the next speaker. That happens to be me. I'm wearing many, many, many hats today. It's the rest of the weekend I'm going to enjoy sitting in the audience. And Gernot is helping me with this. So I have to say something more about the solar history, and I hope there is something in that for all the different types of people who are here. Now, I have something which is going to be a little more visually interesting, but although I have to say this will not compete with the main event of Gernot and Pascal that follows me. But this is about a new organization which I'm starting. What? Some of you know that I have gone to many places, not just for eclipses, but for other reasons, and made longer-term relationships with other people. And the basis behind everything in this organization is that we really all see the same sky. Yeah, I know it's a little different than the southern hemisphere, but it's the same idea. We share the sky. This picture is actually one taken of certain polar stars over an ancient Zoroastrian fire temple in Iran. And I have a number of pictures from there because they're very good at these photographs, and I go to Iran quite often since my first time there for the eclipse in 1999. This was my visit there. This is my own little spotting scope that I use for the partial phases. I'm one of those people who doesn't take pictures or make measurements or anything else. I just sit and watch the eclipses. I have tried a few times to take pictures. I always mess up something, you know, so I mostly don't even try. But I did take one handheld 20mm photograph during totality. This is Nahavan, Iran, northwestern Iran, in the Zagros Mountains. Interesting aspect of this was the sound of prayer coming up from the town below. And I asked about that because I knew it wasn't the time for prayer. They said that they pray to thank God for this great event. And they pray from the beginning to the end. And I said, what about during totality? accomplish that. Patrick was, in fact, very close to me in Iran. We tried to meet up, but failed, and we met today for the first time. What is it, 8 years later? And I was surprised to find that I was very much in demand for autographs and things. They're very interested. Those of you who are Americans would expect it's not safe to go to Iran. It's quite the opposite, the most pro-American country I've ever been. Forget about the propaganda and the media and all that. They have a small observatory here, which I have maintained relationships with. I took this picture not realizing until later that this represents the field of amateur astronomy in Iran, young women. Highly dominant. Women are about 60% of the students in the universities. They dominate the sciences and so on. So very different than we usually think. And they hold public star parties and use very modest equipment to show the sky to people. And I visited one. This is actually the largest telescope existing in the country right now, which is a 20-inch telescope. And my wife here is, can you tell which one is her, the light one? And talking with a bunch of students. And this is where I got the idea, too, that, you know, astronomy and these things, we have so much in common. And this is something that's common to all of us who go to eclipses. You meet people in different cultures. Here she's being greeted at a small girls' school in a rural town. It used to be that I was surprised to find that we had things that were alike. Now I'm surprised when I find anything that's different. Once you get to know the people, we find that we're all really the same. Here, my wife is being asked to sign photographs as well. For those of you who, well, anybody, everybody here, wherever you're from, recognizes this, I think, was about the only building in this town. This is really out of the way. Mickey Mouse was still there advertising. That's not Pepsi Cola, by the way. It's Parsi Cola, meaning Persian Cola. And so I consider Mickey Mouse to be our U.S. ambassador to the world. I'd like to think he is, because I've seen him everywhere I've gone. The transit of Venus, many of you will remember, I took a group to Iran for simple reason that really this might be considered the best place to be. I was right over here. The difference is probably about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So I was in southern Iran in very, very good conditions, taking a group of Americans and some British and a couple of Germans and somebody who snuck in there, you know, Meister from Iran, who is here as well. You can hear from him soon. And Pascal to me, but mostly Americans that I took, and we set up for this next to the tomb of Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire 2,500 years ago in Pasargar. This is a guy who dresses up like Galileo, who goes to schools and does history lessons. He pretends he's Galileo. He wanted to come along, and he asked if it would be okay to do his thing. I said, well, you'd be the only guy I've ever seen walking around in Iran wearing tights. But it's probably okay, so, and he did. And he did a lot of outreach with his sunspotter, showing the sun. This is the day of the transit. Bob Noy from Sky and Telescope magazine came with us. Gerhard Meisser, taking some images from German TV. This is the backside of Richard Berry, for amateur astronomers, will recognize the name from his publications and his editor-in-chief of Astronomy magazine years ago. And we attracted a lot of media attention as well. This is the 2,500-year-old tomb of Cyrus the Great in a satellite uplink station, which I thought was a really good contrast. And they broadcast live from there, basically because we were there, and we were mostly Americans. So I have to show a few pictures. Many of you will have seen this. Hydrogen Alpha, I think, from Canary Islands. I don't know about the rest of you, but I was able to see visually the atmosphere of Venus with the light refracting through it here. And another funny-looking sunspot that someone got. And this one, many of you will know what it is, and the rest of you will think it's a bird or something, but it's the International Space Station. I forget who took this, but he's to be congratulated for being able to set this up, even know where it was going to take place. So they were very, very interested in this small rural town in having us visit. This is sort of an astronomy crazy town. This is a tomb of one of the great poets, Hafez. wanted to talk and, you know, get a chance to talk to Americans and others. Now, this is something that I show frequently, as will not be news to you, though, because these are eclipse pictures, and maybe some of the people in the audience here contributed some of these when I put out a call on SEML. But this, of course, is an eclipse in Africa, where somebody has shared their solar eclipse shades. This is in a tour I led to Panama for the annular phase of the hybrid eclipse in 2005. Is that right? 2005?
Yes.
Sharing, one of our groups sharing this video with some of the locals, a mother and daughter in different fashions of clothes, looking at the partial phases with the shades that that we brought along. Transit of Mercury outside the Vatican. And I'm sorry, I can't remember who took these. I've been using them shamelessly without giving credit for a while, but I have it in my notes. This, of course, is Egypt. And this is in Africa again. Can anybody figure out which one is the visitor?
Yeah.
That person may be here, I don't know. And it's something that we always do. We always share our event and frequently in the night sky with people or other inhabitants who happen to be there. In this case, of course, millions of penguins in Antarctica in 2003. But, and it's something that's common for us, and I use these to show to other people what usually happens when people go to other places and have a celestial event, something that has nothing to do outside of astronomy, has nothing to do with politics, religion, culture, or anything else, something very primal. And you all know what I'm talking about, something like an eclipse. It doesn't have anything to do with where you came from, or what you believe, or who you voted for, or anything else. And the night sky itself is that way as well. This is one more example of a place that I went where it was a very big thing. And as I said, in Iran, I kept relationships for a long time, still go there. This telescope is actually in Spain, but there was a sister telescope, an identical telescope built by Zeiss, and to be placed into this dome right here. It's a 3.5-meter Zeiss telescope, early 1980s, one of the larger telescopes in the world at the time. This happens to be on a mountain in northeastern Iraq. And this was being built in what is now Kurdistan, well, is the Kurdistan region of Iraq, but is really autonomous now. And I was in Baghdad in early 2003, and I had heard about this Iraqi telescope, and nobody knew what happened to it. I even went to the University of Baghdad Astronomy Department. Nobody there knew what had happened to it. I found out later the telescope was actually in boxes at the university, but it was a secret, because what happened was this was nearing completion just at the time when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran. Iranian fighter planes came across the border. They saw a giant, a 30-meter radio dish and these domes, which they figured were for communications or tracking, and so they fired missiles at them. And fortunately, the 3.5-meter was not in the dome at the time. It was immediately taken off the mountain and trucked down to Baghdad for safekeeping. Since then, of course, there have been a couple more wars that have taken place, and Baghdad has not turned out to be the safest area. I was there in October, and I was very interested in this telescope, and it turned out I had an opportunity to find out about it, and I did some reporting on it. I had a short article in Scientific American, and it's a possibility one of the New York Times, but I really was interested in just going there. This is the Kurdistan region of Iraq. It's quite safe, and so I will not go back to Baghdad. So this is from my visit there as well, but it is only a prelude to what I want to talk about. And of course, Krugman and Zeiss, things are still left there from the original manufacturing of solar and optical telescopes. Now, this was the Iranian fighters, and later after Saddam invaded Kuwait and U.S. and British airplanes attacked and created this hole here for the same reason. So a friend of mine, a Kurd, who's standing there to give some idea of the scale of what's taking place. But what's most interesting, what's relevant to this talk, are these people here. This is the Kurdish Astronomical Society, an amateur astronomy association of Kurdistan. And these people in Erbil, the capital, They were instrumental, absolutely crucial to my getting access to this. It's government controlled and they have good connections. These are their telescopes and they have tremendous enthusiasm. They don't have good telescopes. Apparently they have really exceptional skies. And they were extremely excited when I was coming there. Now, Iran, certainly Iraq, some other places that rarely see visitors, just like when you go to eclipses, that's temporary. But in this case, it was more of a connection. And I was coming and I was also bringing them equipment. Some things were donated and some things were purchased with money that they had. It was provided to their club by the government, but they had no way of getting anything. They can't order from Europe because, first, there's no way to send it to them. And second, they have no credit cards. They can't order something online. So I took about 100 kilograms of equipment to them on four airlines and four different flights over 32 hours, and it all arrived at the same time in perfect shape. It was clearly divine intervention. And but I was shocked when I saw this. We are not alone anymore. I am not the Messiah, but to them, you know, somebody who's like dropping out of the sky from a Western country and connecting them with other things. This is a Coronado telescope that I took to them. I don't believe there's another H-alpha filter of any kind in the country. So nobody had seen this before. With their meager budget, somebody sold them very cheaply an 8-inch LX200 telescope. They didn't understand quite what they had at the time. They were amazed they were going to have an 8-inch telescope. They never imagined having something that large. Here they are setting it up very excitedly. Anybody who's ever used an LX200 keypad understands this. What do I do with this thing? There was some observing done, and they are posing very proudly with some binoculars that were donated and the other things. Also, ARC, Rainbow Symphony, donated some 3D glasses and other materials. They'd never seen anything like this before, so they loved this stuff. A camera they got. My favorite part of this picture, though, is apparently you can tell that they're used to seeing people holding AK-47 machine guns. Here they are enjoying this. This was a huge hit for them. It's, you know, the simplest things, and you'd have no idea. They've never seen this, and this is not really a backwards country. This is a report in the ruling party's official newspaper about my visiting there, giving a talk, and so on. And this is just the beginning, because this is the beginning of the idea I had for Astronomers Without Borders. This is something I really wanted to talk about to people here and hope to talk about more, which is simply a network of organizations, groups, clubs, anything related to astronomy or international relations. Use astronomy as a tool to get people together. It's really not about astronomy, eclipses, the sky, or anything else, but these are things that are universal to us. When we look up in the sky, we're all used to seeing this kind of pictures that are taken. I'm not even sure what country this was taken in. It's just all I know is it's the northern hemisphere. This is Orion. You can see the belt. You can see the H-alpha from the Orion Nebula there. This I know is in the desert of Iran. This one is certain polar stars over Yosemite Falls in California. So you see, we see the same thing, and we're amazed by things we see like the Milky Way. There's nobody that fails to be astonished when they see the sky, the Milky Way, in a truly dark sky. This is one I took in Iran, actually, the Venus and Jupiter during the close conjunction in May 2002. This again is Orion, but he's standing on his head. This is taken from Tasmania. Comet Hale-Bopp, just about everybody saw this thing. It looked the same to all of us. Well, this is Tehran, actually, a little out of place, but you know, those of us who live in Los Angeles or other big cities recognize something like this. But this is actually a Messier marathon held on here on the roof of a palace, about a 1,000-year-old royal palace in the desert of Iran, as the moon is setting. Well, Choka, who lives near San Diego, not far from here, took this. this in Utah, and another one in Utah again with Orion, which to me is like a universal symbol. Everybody recognizes it from everywhere in the world. I'm not even sure where that is.
Where's Orion?
Very cold-looking evening. This, I believe, is in northwestern Iran, near Armenia. This is in South Africa, so that's a baobab tree, certain polar stars. Happens to be the south, certain polar stars in this case. Back to Iran, over palace in Pasargar, the capital city of Cyrus founded. And obviously multiple exposures in Yazd, is in the central desert of Iran. This is a picture I took a couple of weeks ago over Crater Lake in Oregon, about 1,500 kilometers north of us in the Cedar, the Crater Lake Lodge here where we stayed on the other side of the lake. And so these things, again, Orion, this is actually that same palace where the people were observing. These are things that we recognize and that others recognize as well. Some of the planets during that same conjunction over a ridge in Isfahan, Iran. Mm-hmm. So we recognize things, these things. We all have the same feelings about it. Leonid meteors of a caravan, sorry, a resting place of caravans in Iran again. Again, the Milky Way. Ooh. So I won't go into more about what we plan to do, but we're building the website. We had to stop for a while. Now I'm going back to having people join us in this virtual online community. There are several projects that are taking place already, one of which is based on these photographs. We'll be collected all over the world in front of, with the sky above, different cultural or natural landmarks. And there's a good chance of very good funding with this, maybe even UN involvement. This will be an exhibition, a demonstration of the universality of all of our feelings about this, online DVDs, various other things. There are other projects involving international outreach. This is something that's useful to us. It's especially useful to those like the ones in Mongolia who recently joined, who will then get better connection with us. And it's rewarding for those of us who are in the West who are able to share our passion that we are so lucky to be able to practice in the way we do with the people who are less fortunate. But even better, the end result is that we form friendships, which I've seen happen time and again. Friendships, communications, understanding, less ignorance, and one can extrapolate that to peace and so on. We do our small part in it, and I hope that everyone here will look us up, take a card from me, and talk sometime during the weekend when there's time, because we're going to go through a very major growth spurt here very quickly, and we want to get everybody involved. Just to be a part of it, no money involved, just to have the clubs there, start building the community. Just as Patrick started and Michael has continued with SEML, this is a larger version that covers more than eclipses. And so that's it. Thank you very much. So this isn't much like any questions or comments that anybody wants to make before I give up the microphone finally for somebody else? Oh, thank you, whoever did that. Thank you, Patrick, you did right. Any questions or anything else before we go on to none? Yes?
Future or near-term project traveling very important?
Yeah, travel is a good part of it. It's one of the problems, of course, is the travel part is expensive, but, you know, I show people to Iran who'd never gone there on their own. And, you know, people like Richard and Eleanor Berry's there as the best trip of their lives. And, you know, these are great places to visit that people don't know about. So that's one thing. Now, it's expensive and so on, but we, for those who can afford it or want to do it on the way to an eclipse or anything else, we will have things like that. One of the things that was presented to me at an Arab Union of Astronomy at a space sciences meeting in Tunisia recently was that the Jordanians wanted to have people come for what I've discussed with some other countries called astro-tourism. They have dark spots. skies. No problem. And they have a good infrastructure and everything else there too, and they have a place for people to stay. So why don't people go there from Western Europe where, you know, the skies are not really dark at all, and visit the sites and everything else? So this is an important part of it too, to be able to have different opportunities to travel and meet people under you know, some circumstances other than taking regular guided tours through astronomy. There are many others as well. Some of them are laid out on the website. More will be soon. And I hope for those of interest we get a chance to talk about it and get together. So.